Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Sign up to our loyalty programme and reap the rewards at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
But now I'm delighted to welcome back to the show author and presenter of the hugely successful How to Fail podcast, Elizabeth Day. Hi, Elizabeth.
Hi, Brendan. Thank you so much for having me back.
I'm delighted to have you back. And I've just read my first Elizabeth Day novel, your new one, and I really, really enjoyed it. So it's called One of Us.
Thrilled.
And it touches on lots of interesting aspects of life and Britain and everything. But before we get to that, you've also picked out five songs for us that have meant something special to you throughout your life. So we'll dive in with the first song. I think it brings you back to your childhood in Northern Ireland. So people might remember your dad was a surgeon. He took a job in Derry City in the early 80s, I think. You all moved over from England. It sounds quite bucolic. Did your dad really buy a donkey and cart and some sheep?
He did, Brendan. You're very well prepared. Yes, he did. So we moved out in 1982. I was 4 years old. And my father's mother had been raised in Northern Ireland. And I think he had this idyllic image of what Irish culture was. And one of the first things he did when we set foot, we actually lived in Clawdy just outside Derry, was to purchase a donkey and cart. And that donkey was called Bess. And Bess had a foal who we called with startling imagination, Little Bess. and there is a photo of us that exists, me and my sister, in the donkey cart, being pulled by Bess. And it honestly looks like something from the 19th century.
It sounds like a John Hind postcard. I don't know if you've ever seen them, but yes. They're like kids and donkeys, usually red-haired children in the John Hind universe. So your parents sound like, were they kind of slightly alternative, interesting people? Because your mother got into windsurfing over in Northern Ireland, did she?
She did. I love that you know all of this. Yes, I would say that they are adventurous and interesting people who were never afraid of taking a chance on doing something unlikely. And they are still those people, and they don't care what others think of them. And I find that incredibly inspiring. And so, yes, my mother got very into windsurfing off McGilligan Beach, if you can imagine that. And I remember being taken there as a child, and I had absolutely no interest in getting into the cold sea or attempting to windsurf because I'm not very well coordinated. But my parents would go and spend hours windsurfing in the sea, and I would be cozied up in the car waiting for them to return, reading a good book. So it probably made me into a writer as well.
So you were the sensible one in the car, and your parents were the free-loving hippies. And what was the music in the house at that stage?
So the music that my parents listened to was very heavily skewed classical. So there was a lot of Handel's Messiah, a lot of Vivaldi's Four Seasons. And then the one thing that I would have classified as popular music when I was young was an ABBA album that my mother had. So ABBA was like the only alternative music that she listened to other than classical. And I remember being so obsessed with this album. It was a thing of startling beauty. It was just this like beautiful blue cover, and they all looked so gorgeous. And my friend Susan Marshall and I used to spend a lot of time devising dance routines to that album when she came over of a weekend. Because this was a kind of pre-internet era, so yeah. We had to make our own fun.
So the only music you had from the current century was actually
was ABBA.
Yeah, no wonder you clung to it so much.
I know. But then I have to say, my sister, who's 4 years older than I am, she discovered cool music earlier than I did. And she used to make mixtapes for my mother that she would then listen to in the car. So we dragged her into the 20th century.
Okay, okay.
And with Bryan Adams.
And we talked before, you were very much an outsider in Northern Ireland. Was it a lonely kind of a childhood?
Well, that's such an interesting question. I don't think it was lonely because I've always been very comfortable in my own company. And I've also been very comfortable in the company of books. I get a great deal of solace from books, and that really dates from my very early years. And I was lucky that I had a lovely primary school experience at Foyle Prep in Derry. And that's where my friend Susan Marshall dates from. So I didn't feel lonely then. And I didn't feel lonely at home because of my older sister, and we had a cat, and we had those donkeys, and we actually got some sheep as well. But I think when I went to secondary school, I went to secondary school in Belfast, and that was a much lonelier period because It's a difficult time anyway. Anyone who has been through early adolescence will know you are so desperate to fit in. And it's at the time when people are finding their tribes and their friendship groups. Mm. And I just didn't fit in from the outset. I've always spoken with this English accent. And I was a year ahead of myself academically. So I was also I was the weird English young kid. And I probably had no fashion sense. And because I'd grown up in a household where ABBA was like the the height of popular taste, you know, I didn't have much street cred either. And that was quite lonely, because I think there's nothing lonelier than being in a crowd of people, and it was quite a big school, but also just feeling so misunderstood and unseen. And so I definitely had that experience.
Okay, and then how does EMF Unbelievable fit into this picture?
EMF actually dates from probably my primary school era. So it was a happier time. And actually, it was my sister who introduced me to the fact that you could buy music that wasn't ABBA on a cassette tape that was called a single. And I remember going to the local Woolworths in Derry, and I remember having saved up my pocket money and buying this single, Unbelievable by EMF, which I must have heard on the radio. And I loved the song because I loved how bold it was and how free it made me feel to listen to it, and how unapologetic the sound was. And I suppose it's no coincidence that I was definitely feeling, whilst I was happy at primary school, I also felt like I didn't fully belong where I lived. And so there was a part of me that wanted to please others, that wanted to be like everyone else. And then to hear this song, which for me, when I hear it, it's about the power of difference, actually. And so I carried on listening to it throughout my secondary school experience, and I got a great deal of strength from it. And I still love it to this day. So I give my younger self a lot of credit for having good music taste.
And also, it's sheer abandon as well, isn't it? Okay, here's Elizabeth Day's first choice. This is EMF Unbelievable.
You're unbelievable. You're so unbelievable. You're unbelievable.
That's EMF Unbelievable. That's Elizabeth Day's first music choice today. So, Elizabeth, you got a scholarship then to go to boarding school in England. You went on to Cambridge to do history. And it's interesting. I feel we're going to talk a bit about class and tribes and stuff today. The title of the book, One of Us, references something I think one of the privileged Oxbridge types says about, I think, is a scholarship boy from a different background. He'll never be one of us. So he went to the right school, and he went to he went to the right college, but he will never be one of us, never be part of their tribe. How did you fit in that milieu in Cambridge?
I really value that you've picked out that phrase in that context, because it's exactly how I felt. I felt that I was never fully one of them. And Britain is still so hidebound by class. And the strange thing was that having grown up in the north of Ireland and felt that it was my home, I didn't feel that I fitted in at secondary school in Belfast because I spoke like I do now. When I got a scholarship to an English boarding school, on the first day I was accepted in a way I'd never been accepted before, simply because of my accent.
Yeah.
But there I didn't belong either, because I hadn't grown up in that milieu. I didn't know the rules. And so much of class is unspoken but codified, and you sort of need to understand the semiotics of it. And it took me a while to get my head around that. So when I went to Cambridge, on one level, it was an incredible experience for me because I loved my subject and I made some of my best friends. And actually, the college I was at did a very good job of accepting people from all sorts of diverse backgrounds. Yet having said that, there was still obviously an elite element to attending that institution. For instance, there were sort of private drinking clubs where you could only join if you'd been to Eton or Harrow. Spoiler alert, no women there. And so, again, I was pitched into this role of observer, and it's a role that I now really value embodying and inhabiting, because I was getting access to rooms that I couldn't fully understand, and I sounded like I belonged, but I didn't really. And there was always a certain element of person at Cambridge and beyond who would definitely make me feel that. And it's why I've become so obsessed with analysing it.
How do you feel it? Like, you're in a situation, somebody would look at you and you'd know in your body that they could see through you,
Exactly that. That's, again, a very profound question. I think it would take me back to being at that school in Belfast and being bullied for being different. There would just be a dismissive way of behaving that was often very rude, but because the person doing the behaviour was from a certain background, it was accepted. Whereas if someone from a lower class had been doing the same things, it would be seen for exactly what it was, which was vicious.
Wow, yeah.
Different standards for people from different backgrounds.
And in terms of how you coped with that then, you did become a people pleaser, kind of, didn't you? And you're also terribly charming. Is developing charm part of being able to move easily in that world as well? Like, do you have to kind of develop skills?
I think so. Well, first of all, thank you for the compliment. Yes, I spent a lot of time trying to please others because I felt that it was dangerous to be unaccepted. And that shaped my life in lots of negative ways, because if you're trying to think of others and you're trying to be nice and you're trying to be kind and you're trying to forge connection, you can also meet and bond with very interesting people. But I do think that charm is part of that. My first job in journalism after university was on the Londoner's Diary, which is like a highbrow gossip column on the Evening Standard. And I felt so nervous, but I had to get used to being sent to parties and bowling up to celebrities who I'd never met before and engaging them in conversation and trying to be newsworthy for the next day's paper. Now, if I had not developed a facility for charm, I never would have been able to do that. And so I think now it's less charm that I have and more the ability to connect, because I know what it's like to feel as though you don't belong. And actually, that's such a universal feeling for so many of us. And even the people who we think have it together and have the most success, they will often feel like that deep down.
Before you got into journalism, you travelled a bit, and I think that's where your second song choice comes from, is it?
That's right. So my second song choice is Sitting on the Dock of the Bay by the late, great Otis Redding. And I had a gap year between school and university where I went and lived in South Africa for 6 months, and I backpacked around Madagascar, aged 18, for a month of that. And then in my university holidays, I would continue the backpacking, and I went to Tunisia and Mexico and Tanzania and all sorts of places. And I just remember this being part of the soundtrack of my student travelling days. And there's one specific memory I have where I was sitting on a jetty in Madagascar and I was listening to this tune, watching the sunset. And there's just, there are a few more sensorily beautiful memories I have than sitting on a jetty in a bay, listening to Otis Redding singing Sitting on the Dock of the Bay.
Okay, heaven, take us away, Otis Redding.
Sitting here 2,000 miles I roam, just to make this dock my home. Now I'm just gonna sit at the dock of a bay, watching the tide roll away. Ooh, I'm sitting on the dock of a bay, wasting time.
Okay, that's Otis Redding, Sitting on the Dock of the Bay, and that's Elizabeth Day's second music choice today, bringing you back, Elizabeth, to a very happy time. But your third song choice, I think, is a sad memory. Tell me about Rich.
Rich was a beloved former boyfriend of mine. So I met him during my second year at university. And he was one of those people, I just remember being so struck by how handsome he was that it almost sort of took my breath away. And then I couldn't believe that he would ever be interested in me, but we got together and it was probably my first real love affair. And it was a relationship that took me beyond university the first year after graduating. And then very sadly, we broke up. And 6 months after we broke up, he flew himself to Iraq to cover the fallout after the second Iraqi war as a freelance journalist. And I knew that he was going and I was invited to his leaving party and I didn't go because I didn't want to make it awkward. And it's one of the regrets that I have that I didn't go, because 2 weeks later he was killed by an unidentified sniper. And I think about him all of the time. And I know that his death decimated his family emotionally and decimated his friends emotionally. We miss him still. And I can't believe that, you know, 21 years have passed since that. And one of the things that I remember most about Rich, there are two actually. One is that he would be the person at a party, deep in conversation with the guest who possibly no one else would have thought of speaking to. And he would be craned over, listening intently to what that person had to say. He could connect with almost anyone. And the second thing that I think of when I think of him is his music taste. He introduced me to so much music that I had not heard before. And one of the tracks that he introduced me to was Homelands by Nitin Sawhney, which is a stunning piece of music. And it's extremely emotional for me to listen to. But I wanted to choose it today because I feel that music, at its best, it reaches places that mere words can't. And so I feel close to Rich when I listen to this.
OK, here's Homelands by Nitin Sawhney. Gama pa ma pa ga, gama ma sa ni ni. Saga pa ma pa ga, gama pa ma pa ga, gama ma sa ni ni. That's Homelands by Nitin Sawhney, and that's Elizabeth Day's third music choice today. And thank you for sharing that very evocative memory with us, Elizabeth. Okay, so your novel, One of Us, there's a lot in there. There's politics, addiction, abuse, but as we were saying, class and the upper classes especially. One thing I was thinking reading it was, you were talking the last time about when you do men in your podcast, How to Fail, they can find it harder to think of their failures. And this book has a fair few. The men tend towards the overconfident and the women tend towards doubting themselves.
Yes, I think it is like that a lot, to be honest. And I think particularly the men that I examine in One of Us, because they come from a certain political class, a kind of elite, moneyed, semi-aristocratic class, they have never had to doubt their place in the world. Whereas women often do tend to turn that doubt or insecurity inwards and feel that they are the ones at fault. And so I wanted to look at that, and I wanted to look at that all through the prism of five main characters. And one of those characters is a woman called Serena, who is my kind of age, actually. And it was the first time I'd written a female character who was going through menopause at the same time as I was. But I think there's something particularly pertinent in your question about women of a certain age. And Serena represents that for me because she, like me, I was born in the late 1970s. I'm either an elder millennial or a Gen Xer. And when we were raised in the 80s, we were still raised as young girls to please others, to be kind, to put others' needs and wants first. And actually, the knock-on effect of that, for me anyway, and definitely for Serena, was that we forgot to find out who we were and what we wanted. And so Serena is going through this moment of reckoning where she thinks, oh, well, hang on a second. I've allowed myself to gain my own worth from being valued by men. And now she feels she's losing the beauty that she once so valued, and now she's sort of re-examining her place in the world. And so, yeah, there's a lot of that in One of Us. And I should also say, I hope it's funny as well as dealing with these serious issues, because life is absurd at the same time as being sort of serious and textured.
Yeah, it's funny, and it's double funny for us because of our complicated relationship with posh English people. So trust me, it's very right. funny for Irish people. The issue of body image comes up for Serena and for the women in the book too. You wrote a great piece there over the summer. I thought it was really interesting about the weight loss drugs, but I think more the lifestyle use of them and how they triggered your old, like 80s, 90s conditioning around body image. Just tell me a bit about that.
Yes, it was something that I had to pluck up my courage to write, which in and of itself I find interesting because I have so much shame attached to body image issues. And I'm really glad you brought this up because Serena is definitely struggling with it as well. And again, it pertains to people who came of age, particularly in the 80s and 90s, when we were routinely told by the tabloid press, by magazines that would circle women's cellulite and call it shame, by TV chat show hosts who encouraged female celebrities to weigh themselves. So all of that happened and made ordinary girls, young women, feel like failures for not being able to live up to these impossible standards. And whilst I've never had an eating disorder, I think it is probably an experience common amongst many women that I definitely have disordered thoughts around eating. And I really wish that I didn't. And I feel like it would be a radical act of feminism not to have those thoughts. But the reality is that I do. And I felt that we had made so many strides in terms of accepting who we are, in terms of the positivity movement. And it feels as though the ready availability of weight loss jabs for genuine health reasons, but the ready availability of weight loss jabs in certain social circles has sort of brought it all up again. For so many of us, we're just feeling this constant pressure to be thinner. And I wanted to write a really honest piece about how I feel that, even though I am so privileged to live in a healthy, strong body. And I'm fairly slim, but I still have this constant noise that I have to make an active effort to reject. And so, yeah, I wrote this piece and I wanted to be honest, even though I felt weird about being honest about it. And then actually, I had so many readers get in touch saying that they'd resonated with it. So I think that there is something there. And I actually now have got to the stage where I'm like, it's an active choice every day to reject that because I want to be interesting, Brendan. I don't want to waste a single more minute thinking about how much I weigh if I don't have to, and I don't have to. And I think it's boring. And so I strive every day to be a more interesting version of myself.
And are you seeing it all around you in some of the circles you move in that there are people who did not have an obesity problem, but who are kind of very thin now because they're clearly on these drugs?
Yes, I see it a lot. And maybe that's because I exist in a kind of rarefied media metropolitan elite bubble, but I don't think it is because I also know from other friends of mine that they will see mums at the school gate doing it. And again, I say all of this with absolutely no judgment in the sense that everyone has to choose their own path.
Yeah.
But it is like, it's scary. You know, I've done events with actresses where I felt like a quarterbacker because they are all, these beautiful women are just shrinking themselves. And it's so upsetting to me because actually, as women, I think we should be taking up more space on this planet.
How you're still obviously very driven kind of individual, right? How are your kind of self-esteem and, you know, those tendencies towards perfectionism and stuff in general now?
Thank you for asking, Brendan, because I...
Well, I'm sorry. I hope it wasn't too blunt a question.
No, I loved it because we spoke about this. And I just want to say, you know, for the record, I had such incredible feedback from that conversation. And it was like a deeply therapeutic conversation for me, too. So thank you. And my self-esteem issues are better than they were then. And every time I do something I feel nervous about and it's not a massive disaster, that's something I can put in the pot of self-esteem. I'm like, I've got, OK, well, I've done this. And that's part of my expertise now. It's part of my toolkit. And that really, really helps. And the other thing that has helped is understanding that the work I do, if I'm doing it right, I hope that it connects deeply with one person. And I'm lucky enough to know that lots of my work has connected deeply with one person and many times more than one person. That's the kind of work that I value. I don't necessarily value work that has lots and lots and millions and millions and millions and millions of people, that has such broad appeal that the appeal in and of itself is rendered a bit meaningless because it's appealing to all tastes. My work is specific and I value depth over noise. And that's been really helpful in terms of reducing the volume dial on my perfectionism because I feel less competitive. I understand that the fulfillment I get is from the work that I do and the people that I connect with.
Okay. When we last spoke, you had kind of really quite recently made your peace with not having children and you tried hard for a long time. Does that kick into a new, freer phase in life now as you move into that acceptance more?
Definitely, because I spent 12 years trying and failing. That's my word that I use because that's what it felt like. It's very difficult not to internalize that. And now I no longer have to feel that I'm failing every single day. And so, yes, I have an enormous amount of peace that I never expected on the other side of that. And a huge amount of liberation, a huge amount of creative opportunity, if you like, because I am lucky enough to have a career that fulfills me and that enables me to be creative in different ways. And now I feel like the safety wheels are off. And that if I am going to live my one precious life and I'm not going to be a mother, then in what other ways can I make it meaningful and can I make it authentically mine? So, yeah, in answer to your question, that's been a huge part of it.
Excellent. Good to hear it. OK, we've two more songs, so let's get them. Your next song is for your husband, Justin. It's Etta James, At Last. What does this bring you back to?
This brings me back to walking down the aisle towards Justin on our wedding day. It was the song that was playing then because it felt so resonant for both of us. We had both been through first marriages, divorces, days in the singles wilderness of the late 30s. And I finally met Justin at the age of 39 when I was rapidly losing hope that I would actually meet my life partner. And then at last, as Etta James sings, there he was.
Okay, nothing wrong with a bit of relief when you're walking down the aisle. That's a valid feeling to have at your wedding. Okay, here's Etta James, At Last.
At last, the skies above are blue. My heart was wrapped up in clover. The night I looked at you.
That's Etta James, At Last, and that's Elizabeth Day's fourth song choice today, bringing her back to walking down the aisle. And Elizabeth, we started on a great party classic and we're ending on a party classic. Why is your final song House of Pain?
Oh, Jump Around by House of Pain. It's because it's my favourite dance floor filler. I love it so much. It makes me so happy. I've been known to go up drunkenly to DJs in clubs and to ask for them to play it. I know the lyrics. And I remember very vividly stepping up onto a banquette at my 40th birthday party and dancing to this track. It never fails to make me feel great.
Okay, give me a bit. Will you start it for us?
Me?
Yeah, go
me?
On. Go on, go on.
Yes.
Get it going for us there. Go on.
Oh my God, no, I can't. Wait, how does it start? Okay. Oh yeah.
Back it up.
Back it up, back it in. Let me begin.
Excellent. Okay. One of Us is published by Fourth Estate. It's out now. And Elizabeth, you'll be in conversation with Roisin Ingle at the Dublin Book Festival in the RAIM on the 29th of October. And so we'll finish up today on the original version of your final choice, House of Pain and Jump Around. Elizabeth Day, thank you so much.
Bye, Brendan.
Bye.
Pack it up, pack it in. Let me begin. Feeling funky, amps in a trunk, and I got more rhymes than this cop's at a Dunkin' Donut shop.
rte.ie.